disturbing turtle nesting eggs?
Yes, that's a third-degree felony in the state of Florida. And listen, I know one of you guys like to go lobster hunting. You catch a lobster, the tail is too short. Man, listen, that's a third-degree felony. You're not going to vote again.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm America's newest zaddy, Hari Kondabolu. Watch out, Jeff Goldblum.
And once again, we're two comedians trying to make sense of American politics.
Yeah, and this is the year we will totally do that. This is definitely the year.
That means talking to the people doing the work for our democracy.
Like my buddy, Alexander Rojas.
She heads up Justice Democrats, the PAC that brought us the squad.
And they continue to put the heat on out-of-touch corporate Democrats in Congress.
We'll also talk to my friend Desmond Mead.
He led the movement to restore the right to vote for nearly 1.4 million people who've served their time in Florida prisons.
Desmond is in no way finished. He's preaching hope, getting out the vote, fighting for his own right to take the bar exam, and occasionally having to deal with Governor Ron DeSantis. Ugh.
And he's written a new book, Let My People Vote.
Hope he mentions it. It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Kamau, we're doing the podcast again.
Yeah, isn't it weird?
it's very weird. It's like time hasn't moved.
Time has certainly moved. I mean, mm-hmm. I just have to admit that I thought that we were done. not as friends. I think a lot of people thought we were done as friends.
Right,
but
right,
I thought
right.
we were. I thought I just sort of thought we were only supposed to do one season. We did two seasons.
Right.
America voted it, basically by voting in Trump. It voted against Politically Reactive, and so we were like, All right, well, we're done now. But we're back. People seem to always be more excited about the things you used to do than the things you're doing.
Yeah.
But so I still hear about people like, yay, United Shades, new season's out. But I still really only care about Politically Reactive. the volume never, I thought it would eventually go away. Like with Totally Biased, the volume has come down on people wanting to come back significantly.
Sure.
But with this, it just never seemed to stop. And I think that really, to be quite clear, if you guys hadn't kept talking to us about it, we wouldn't be here right now. So
that's correct. That's 100% correct.
If you don't like it, it's your fault.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Like, this is like people asking for, oh, come on, just one more season of Arrested Development. Please, can't somebody, Netflix, you can, are you sure? I mean, none of the actors are really available, so you'd have to shoot them separately, and it's not going to be that. No, totally. It's going to be amazing. Things never get old, ever. Well, you know, it's there. I'm glad it's there, but, you know, it's. Would you have been really sad if it hadn't come back? Let me ask you that question. Would you have been happy with just the memory of what it was?
Are we talking about us or Arrested Development? I'm a little confused now.
Arrested Development, but it's also hinting at us.
The show, we sort of talked about if it's going to come back, we have to really do it in a different way. I mean, so, you know, because the world is different and we also feel like we have to sort of sharpen the attack of the show. You know, so part of this is that we're really going to try to focus on sharing resources with you all to help make this country a better place. I say this world a better place. We should focus on the country first.
Because
the world's doing better than us generally. With the social unrest in the country and the COVID, I have been the hub of, I've joked that I'm every white talk show host favorite black friend. I've done more talk show appearances since George Floyd and Breonna Taylor than I have done before that. Rest in power to those two. But so I'm the hub of white people saying, what should I do? So here we're going to tell you what to do.
That's funny because I think, you know, this has also been, in terms of television appearances, a good time for Indians on television because there's more Indians on TV than ever before, but they're all doctors because of COVID. And it's this weird thing of like, I see a different Dr. Patel on every single network. And part of me is happy about that. And the other part of me is like, this is really reinforcing the stereotype that all Indians are doctors. And
yeah, we've got two Dr. Guptas now. There's one on MSNBC in addition to Sanjay on CNN. And of course, I did the thing that everybody did. Are they related? And I Googled it and they're not related because Guptas are very common. I don't have to explain this to you.
right. God, they're both named Smith. But how is that possible?
I will say this about Sanjay. I don't know Dr. Sanjay Gupta, but I've really enjoyed a couple things about him. He looks like, even since very early with COVID, he looks like he's pissed when he's on CNN. Yes. he looks like you just don't think of him as being a guy who is angry. Like Chris Cuomo is CNN's anger guy.
Yeah.
But Sanjay Gupta just looks like he's like biting his lip. Like I'm waiting for blood to trickle from his bottom lip when he's on there. Like especially they'll play a clip of Trump talking. And he's just like, son of a, like just like, and he's also doing the thing with COVID where he's actually staying, he's clearly sheltering in place. There's a little mullet coming out on Sanjay.
I was about to say, it actually works really well with the anger.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's almost like his anger grew that mullet.
Exactly. Hold on a second. I'm hearing a knock at my door. This is not for the podcast. I just think one of my kids is knocking the door and it's remote learning and I just want to be a good dad and check. You'll get there eventually. They'll still be remote learning by the time that your kids are my kids' age, just so you know.
There's a knocking at the door. There's somebody coming in from the outside.
So, Harish, talking about kids, you got one.
I have a child, Kamau.
Yes.
I have a little boy named Arjun, and me and my partner Jocelyn are very happy, and we're very tired.
Those two things go together with the kid, happy and tired. Just so you're aware, you're never going to catch up on sleep again.
Yep,
I mean, here's the thing. I say this. It's very possible that you do catch up on sleep again. Then that's one of the signs of being a bad parent, just so you know. So if you ever feel like if you feel rested like for 7 straight days, then your kids are either out of town with some family member or person you trust, or you're a really bad parent.
In this particular, because I'm rested right now because Joss said that she'd watch the kid without me so I could like, we're in San Diego right now because her parents are here, so we had the baby out here. And so she said, I'll stay with the kid at the apartment we're staying at. Why don't you stay with my parents so you can get sleep so this episode goes great? So it might say how terrible a parent I am, but how great a parent she is.
No. These are the negotiations. This is good parenting when one parent recognizes that you need sleep. So like I think, but I guess, like I said, one night of good rest or 2 nights is fine. But if it's 7 days in a row, especially the kid at this age, then you're like, if you told me, man, I slept so good the last 7 days, I would call Joss and be like, is he not around? Like, what is he doing wrong?
I think the biggest change is my level of cynicism. I feel like before, and we joked about it on the podcast, when we talked about the end of the world, I almost felt a relief in it. Mm-hmm. Like, finally, human suffering is over. It's finally done, you know? And now mm-hmm. that I have a kid, I can't feel that way. Mm-mm. It's like, oh, but the kid hasn't even experienced anything. And I want my kid to live a long and happy life. And at least until the Knicks make the NBA finals again. So like,
wow.
Into his 70s and 80s at least. Right?
So you're talking about life extension technology. Then. Right, so you think your kid's going to be 150 years old. All right,
right
good,
before
good.
They even have another shot at it. So, yeah. You know, it just my whole view of everything is changed in that regard.
Let's talk about your president Donald Trump, hurry.
He's not my president. Who told you this?
Let's talk about President Donald John Trump, who has COVID, but there's a lot of people who believe he does not have COVID because you know, I think there's a tendency to not trust anything he says, which I understand. First of all, let's start here. Do you believe the president has COVID?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I tend to believe he has COVID just because I think of him as being a liar. I don't think of him as being that smart enough to be like that level of evil genius.
To get all those doctors aboard, I think is the part that makes me think he's not lying. Like, knowing him, first of all, if he like, I'm surprised that he admitted he had COVID just because considering who Donald Trump is, I assumed he would have kept asking doctors till he found the one that would agree that he didn't have it. Because that's his approach to everything, it seems like, to find the one who will go along with him.
Like that long-haired New York doctor who was like, who quote, wrote that press release, he's the most healthy person in the history of health or whatever it was.
Oh, you mean Dr. Funk?
Yeah, Dr. Funk.
Oh, yeah, he's been doing a funk cover show for years out in the Village. Yeah, Dr. Funk.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, so I tend to agree with you. I think he's got it. Also, I think that if he didn't have it and wanted us to believe he had it, we wouldn't have heard about the battery of experimental medicines he took. I think he would have just been like, I have COVID, but I went outside. And I took a deep breath and now I don't have it. He would have just said he would have, like, I sweated it out or something. He would have just told us something.
I just stayed in one of my Trump hotel rooms while eating a Trump steak. And these Trump steaks cure COVID.
Yes, that's what he would have done if he didn't have it. I think he has it. I just think that time will tell. It's still early days. But, like, it is. Like, a huge percentage of people are asymptomatic and get through it very lightly. But then, as we know, some people, it hits really hard and it kills over 200,000 Americans so far. So it's like, it's, you know, there are people who get through it with no big deal. He could be that guy despite all of his, comorbidities and everything else. But he's also, I sort of feel like he's like Roaches and Keith Richards. He's just going to be here. Here's what I think. I think Trump should call his entire cabinet. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Matt Gaetz, Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, in a closed door Oval Office meeting just to see how committed they are to the fact that he had that 4-day COVID. You know what I'm saying? Like, just like a whole day meeting, like a closed door. We need to really talk about just to prove how committed they all are to the idea that no, it's he just had the 4-day COVID. On that note, just vote. Just vote, everybody. And I mean, I there's more to do, and we will talk about that on the podcast of other things we can do to hopefully pull America out of this ditch, because no matter who wins the election, America is still going to be trying to get out of the ditch that we are in right now. But yeah, a big part of it is voting, but there's also other things you can do before and after Election Day.
And I know there's a lot of stuff in this episode we're not going to be able to cover because, you know, we've been out of this for 3 years. So for those of you who are like, how come, you know, you're not talking about BLM right now and the protests and all the things that have happened? The show's about an hour. we missed about 3 years. And so I promise you, we will get to these things. Kamau and I will cover all the things that you know, that we wanted to cover when we weren't on air, that we thought, if we only had a way to reach people with this. So it's just there isn't enough time to cover all of it right now, but we'll get there.
In a little bit, we're going to be talking to the amazing Desmond Mead. Desmond is the president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, the people who passed Amendment 4 in 2018, which returned the right to vote to 1.4 million people who were back in their communities after doing time in Florida's prisons.
But first, we're going to check in with my buddy Alexander Rojas, executive director at Justice Democrats, the political action committee that helped get the squad elected in 2018, and that's behind some of the most exciting progressive candidates today, people like Jamal Bowman in New York and Cori Bush in St. Louis.
Cori Bush, by the way, is going to be on the show next week, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. But first, let's start at the top, how Alexandra and I first met.
Yes, that's the most important place to start at, Hurry. Absolutely.
This is great. I mean, we met, I think it was about a year ago, I think, at the Way Forward conference, right? And they had me perform at 8 in the morning. I remember too. In front of a room full of activists and organizers who, as the audience might know, have the easiest senses of humor. They're completely not beaten down by the system. They're completely willing to laugh at anything because they're totally not being thoughtful about everything at all times.
And eight in the morning is the best time for a comedy audience.
Oh, that's my God. Time. As soon as you wake up, hearing some man's opinions is exactly what you are. So not just hearing them, but have them yelled at you the way I do.
I loved it because the story is what made it.
Oh, I've never shared that story. Okay.
Yeah, you get that. That was why I was like, what? This is like crazy. I happen to be listening in the audience. And you're also really funny.
I like the fact, despite how that story ends, you still wanted to work together. in brief, but I got a message from AOC like during her campaigning the first time around,
Well, let's be clear. It's from. She wasn't AOC then. She was.
No,
just,
she was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or as I, wrote Alexandra, because that's how much attention I was paying at the time. So she had some really nice things to say because she was, you know, representing Jackson Heights, and you know, I grew up in Jackson Heights, and I thought that was so cool. And I said, well, why don't you get back in touch with me at some point, and maybe we could work together, because I'm really busy right now, because I was working on that Apu documentary and my Netflix special, and I'm like, well, what could be more important than that? No way that this is going to be one of those figures that changes the world. Could this person possibly have more impact than a documentary about an old cartoon character? I don't understand. And so
Rosa Parks, let me know after that bus thing goes down. Then I'll get back in touch with you.
Maybe you'll be on the podcast.
Harriet Tubman, let me know after you bring some slaves up here. Then we'll talk about what's going on.
So she writes back. Despite that, she still writes back. A few months before the election, and says, hey, I'd love to collaborate still, you know, at some time. Like, I really think we can do something great for the community. Like, it was still, it was framed in such a, like, this is a great person. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'll get to this. I'll get to this eventually. I'll get to this. Then all of a sudden, and I was focused clearly on myself, the primary results come in. I'm watching CNN, and she won, and then it clicked. Oh my God, I think that was the lady from before. Oh no, is that the Twitter lady? Was that the lady I was exchanging DMs with? And it was. And shamelessly, despite all of it, I wrote her that night and was like, oh my God, congratulations. I knew you'd win. Oh my God, I was being such a phony. She never wrote back. I think she might have gotten busy. I would like to think it's because she got busy and not because she remembered that message and never wrote back. But yeah,
the
I told
the happy ending though is that you followed up with Jamal. It was great.
That's true. That's true.
So it worked out.
I remember you contacted me like you mentioned for Jamal Bowman's fundraiser at Eastville Comedy Club, and the fact that it was at Eastville Comedy Club and he's a former middle school teacher. Again, I didn't bother doing the basic bit of research. I'm like, oh, he must be. Going for city council or an assembly position, because it's a comedy club in Brooklyn, and I get there, the crowd's amazing, and that's when I realize this dude's running for the House. He's going after Elliot Engel, and I think that speaks a lot to what Justice Democrats and the movement is, because this wasn't a $500 a plate fundraiser. This was not corporate money. This was a comedy club in Brooklyn. And you had this incredible base of people that were so excited to see him, and he was so gracious, and he won. Like, he beat Elliot Engel, you know, for the Democratic nomination. And I mean, it's just that to me speaks so much to the spirit of what you do, as well as like the energy that you had immediately. I mean, again, I didn't know you were the ED immediately because of like when I think of EDs, I usually think of much older, beaten down, sending subordinates to do the work. And you were like on it. You had this energy and you were for it. And I just think it's meeting you. It's like this is so much of the spirit of this movement. How did you get involved in political organizing and in Justice Democrats?
I graduated high school, not to take it all the way back, but in to expose my age, but in 2013, and I had moved. I'm from Connecticut, the Hartford area.
Oh, just hold on. My mind just exploded. Give me a second.
Yeah.
Okay, continue.
Yeah. Still a baby. Well, kind of. But I moved out to California right after graduating high school, and my path in California, it takes a year and one day to prove residency. They have a great community college system. I'm a huge fan of community college. So I was going, you know, for the first year, I just worked, you know, I had a few different jobs trying to prove residency. And once I got it, I went to the community college system. They basically pay for everything. And I went to a school that was hopefully going to transfer me to a UC. And they had like an amazing transfer rate. It turns out that like the University of California's have different requirements than the state in terms of how they classify in state versus out of state. And so this entire time I had thought I was going to go to school in state, which is like $25,000. Out of state goes up to like probably like closer to like 60,000, including everything a year. And I found out I was going to have to basically go out of state. And it had been a few years of me working and spending a lot of time in state. And I'm like, it's not the end of the world, but it's like, all right, I've got to figure stuff out, or I can take a break. And it just happened to be 2015 when Bernie Sanders first announced his run for president. I was, you know, doing a lot of student organizing on the in community college. I was working and I had just found out, I was like, you know, trying to decide if I wanted to take out this monstrous amount of debt to go to school. And I really didn't want to. So I decided not to and ended up just going all in as one of those crazy Bernie people, organizing for Bernie in 2016 on different community college campuses with a bunch of my friends, and just bugged the shit out of the campaign until I got hired in January and like drove down with like, or well, I guess it's like kind of up because it's Southern California to Burlington, Vermont. That was right, like, right. You can work on the campaign, but you have to be an intern and you have to live in Vermont. Oh, and we like, you have to like barnstorm at different colleges along the way, which we were like, yeah, we'll do whatever. Like, let's talk to the kids. We're kids, you know? and so I worked on the National Distributed campaign. That's where I met some of the other founders of Justice Democrats. And one of the big things was like, you know, Bernie is amazing, but no matter who becomes president, Congress is broken, right? It's been in gridlock, but also it's just bought by corporate interests in both parties. And so one of the ways to, you know, defeat that at the time was like, let's run, you know, this idea of slates of candidates, not looking at elections in silos in primaries, right? Because that was a competitive primary, on, you know, an agenda that is big enough to inspire people to do big things. So that's where we've taken it, to Congress explicitly.
Historically, it's almost like, well, you have to start here and then you work your way here and then you become a jaded career politician and then you move up. And this is like kind of going back to what democracy was meant to be like back in Athens. Like, you're a regular everyday person and you have validity and you know the experience that your fellow, you know, Americans are having, you know, as opposed to being a career politician, you actually were a bartender or were just a student or, you know, like Cori Bush, like, you know, a pastor, an organizer, and you are most capable. You are the most capable person to represent your people than somebody who's been out of it for so long. I love that so much. How do you get everyone on the same page? Because it feels like, even though like so much of it is based on working class people and marginalized people getting those folks to run, like, there's going to be a difference of opinion, right? Like, you're not going to have everyone on the exact same page on everything. Are you focused more on their backgrounds and first, like, that they're working class, that they have the story, and then do you think about like the politics, or do you make sure the politics line up right in the beginning?
I think that we've got an approach that's I describe as like part art, part science, in the sense that we've got the art part, a nomination form. Since the moment we've launched, like, we believe that in order for us to like truly reflect the diversity of America, not just ethnicity, but background, we've got to crowdsource from like everybody in America to do that. So in that sense, anybody can go right now to justicedemocrats.com/nominate to nominate anyone in your community. But we want folks from like all parts of our society and economy, right? And that was like, that's been the way that we found Alexandria, through her nomination from her brother. Jessica Cisneros was nominated by her high school teacher, Jamal by a fellow education activist. So that part is like, no matter what, like, you have to have the ability for I think, no matter how our message gets out, sometimes it's paid, right, through paid communications, but a lot of times it's organic through us, like, having these upset victories, doing, you know, the press, organic stuff like that. But it's also science in the sense that we look at a lot of data, right? And that's quantitative, qualitative, like, for example, like Joe Crowley being a white male incumbent in a majority minority district. Same with Jamal Bowman's incumbent with Elliot Engel, right? That's sort of like a qualitative narrative piece. But then there's also like an assessment of election data, demographic information, what votes they've taken, right? Just kind of looking at the full spread of like information across the country for us, especially looking at safe blue districts and open competitive seats, to see if it makes sense for us, you know, if there are trends there that sort of identify with what we've identified as being, you know, a mix for success in a given district, or even if it's not success, like, that it feels within reach. And a lot of times, like especially right now in the Democratic Party, we're changing that, but there is like a 97% incumbency rate. So a lot of times these people haven't been challenged 10, 20, 15 years or 25 years. And you know, doesn't matter. I feel like this cycle was kind of seeing, you know, we did it in 2018. They had some time to prepare for us coming. I think they're going to have more time to prepare in terms of the Democratic establishment the next time. But also, these are some folks that haven't had to run elections in just a really long time. So how much can you really prepare? So I think it's all of those things. And then the candidate themselves, right, is like policy is our North Star. And taking no corporate money, they've got that. That's like no matter what, a candidate has to support that. But I think it's also just what is this person's lived experience that prepared them to, you know, withstand going up in a body that has hundreds of people that are trying to tell you not to be doing what you're doing. And the more times we win, like this cycle, if we elect Kara Eastman, who's our final Justice Democrat in the general, we'll have doubled the size of the squad and not even in one cycle. So it's a really good return on our investment, and it's getting easier for folks like Cori Bush and AOC and Jamal to actually say yes to running, because before that was also very difficult to get folks to do.
Right now, specifically, there's so much fear of Trump and the GOP and Trumpism that, as you know, a lot of Democrats are like, we should just be unitying and coming togethering and not, don't challenge an incumbent, because we already have, any Democrat is better than a good Democrat, like, or, you know, whatever the narrative is, that like, if we have these Democrats who are there, why challenge them?
Well, I mean, I would just take a look at what's happened to our country in the midst of this pandemic right now. Like, obviously, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are fucking evil, and they have totally botched the governance of this whole thing. But it's also like the degradation of our national supply chain. Like, that is not just them. That is a failed elected leadership at many, many different levels. And that is not just Republicans, that's Democrats as well. And I think that we've got to take a hard look at not just people that are getting the rhetoric right, but having a sense of urgency while you're in office to really fight with every tooth and nail. And like, right now, the Supreme Court, you know, the Republican Party has had this strategy of basically going after the court system, knowing that the civil rights movement and everything that we fight for, right, is there. They are ruthless with that approach. And so I think that we have to take a similar attitude towards not just the Republicans, but any politician that is sort of refusing to accept how terrifying this moment is for not just young people like myself, but millions of Americans, right? Like, we have a choice right now. We can either have this crazy unprecedented level of income inequality. We have zillionaires like Jeff Bezos and like people walking out of getting COVID, like millions of people with like $75,000 worth of medical debt or like debilitating conditions for the rest of their life, or we can do something about it. And so I think that's sort of the moment that we're in. And I think where Justice Democrats is really trying to be that tip of the spear, showing you have to fight, and it's now. And that's what the Democratic Party stands for.
And speaking of you have to fight, can you talk about the Kara Eastman race? Because that seems like a race that is key and that you have targeted as being a key race in the upcoming election.
We mostly get involved in competitive primaries, but it's our only red to blue that we're involved in. She actually ran in 2018, and Marie Newman's out in Illinois' district and Cori Bush just won in Missouri's first. They both lost the first time in 2018 and have won this time around. So we're hoping that holds true for Kara as well. But it's different. This is a Trump Republican, Don Bacon, who has voted hell yes to gut the Affordable Care Act and pre-existing conditions. And it, you know, last time around, like, we lost by 5,000 votes. Joe Biden is up about 7 points in the district. Kara is, I think, there's just one poll that showed her within the margin of error. So I think within 2 points. But this race is actually pretty consequential for the presidency. So there's only Nebraska and Maine are the only two states that give out by congressional district. And so, like, investing in Kara's race actually is investing in Joe Biden, hopefully winning that seat. So it's not like if Kara loses, Joe Biden doesn't get that. But it is important for our movement, right, to show that you don't have to water down your message. You can be a strong progressive that refuses corporate PAC money in the Midwest with an, a frontliner that doesn't have to compromise like some of the others on the Democratic side feel like they need to do right now and put things like immigration and stuff on the chopping block. So I think she's really important for our whole movement. Folks can check her out, but phone banking, donating, everything. It's all hands on deck for her for November 3rd.
One thing I love about the Justice Democrats is that they fulfill a really important Democratic function that's been lacking. You know, like they're almost a third party within a two-party system because, you know, when I think about the parliamentary system, you know, in like the UK, it's like the left and right are checked by these other parties that hold them accountable, right? So if you can be a moderate person on the left, but if the, you know, the socialist party has enough votes and has enough support, it's going to push you in that direction because you're not going to get their support otherwise. And I feel like that's kind of what Justice Democrats is doing. It's like, you know, you can't ignore us anymore. For all these years, I think the folks that were on the progressive left were ignored because we just didn't have the votes or we didn't have the power. And Justice Democrats, you know, represents that power. But the thing is, when I see the Justice Democrats, it's a lot of people of color. It's very young. So what is it that the establishment is afraid of? Because they're looking at their future and they're looking at people who are fulfilling the promises and who are trying to meet the goals that they have set. Like, you know, idealistically, they said, this is what we want in the future. Well, these are the people that are giving you the future that you claim you want. What are they afraid of?
I mean, I think like many people are, I think they're afraid of change. 'Cause I think change for them means that, you know, their lifestyle, the current way of doing things that is currently in their favor just isn't going to be that way anymore. And I think rather than, I think, giving in to what's inevitable, right? The demographics of this country are changing ideologically and like in terms of AOC being like, so, you know, in addition to her just being an incredible, you know, one of the most gifted communicators in American politics, she also represents, like, you know, in places like Texas, right, and Georgia, like changing demographics of young Latinos. And so I think that it's a little short-sighted to not take that into account if you're trying to build a Democratic Party to last. But I think fundamentally it is being afraid of change, because that would mean, you know, especially, you know, when we talk about getting money out of politics, like we've got a serious problem in Washington where we got this corrupt probably billion-dollar lobbying operation that exists on the Hill across all of these different special interests that are in their faces from the moment they get sworn in to when they leave. That's why it's so important for our movement to not just think about social movements, but merge that into electoral organizing and recognizing that putting, you know, folks in office like Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush are actual tangible evidences of our power and represent millions of people across this country. We're building a really strong faction within the Democratic Party that can wield power, and especially under a Joe Biden presidency, that's going to be critical to make sure that we're not doing the bare minimum, but we are making sure that every person in this country, especially when we talk about healthcare, we go forwards and not backwards.
During the recent presidential debate, I mean, calling it a debate already seems absurd. It wasn't a debate, but the yelling match, you know, Trump brought up the Green New Deal. And, you know, I think it's something that the right has done. They've weaponized at least the phrase Green New Deal, because it's not like anybody knows what the policy is. It's just that the idea, this is something that the left wants and says that's what Biden wants. And Biden immediately backs up. It's like, no, that's not my plan. I'm not doing the Green New Deal. I have my own Biden plan. When you hear that, you know, as someone working in the progressive left, does it burn a little bit like this is a good plan? I hate the fact we're seeing this compromise and this is being dismissed. Or do you see it as, well, look, we got some of these things in an agenda that would have been ignored otherwise?
We don't do this work to get Joe Biden to like us. And quite frankly, if we look at history, none of these people will ever, right? Like, and Nancy Pelosi, honestly, has been a lot harsher to us, Dianne Feinstein, to all those kids telling him, hey, why don't you run for senator in like 30 years? Like, so he wasn't like that as bad, I'll say, right. just from that standpoint. And you're right. I mean, like, at the end of the day, we're at the negotiating table. AOC, Sunrise, were part of the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force, and he moved up his climate plan from 2050 to 2035, which was almost 20 years. And that's even more than what folks running for president in 2016 were at. So they can come kicking and screaming, but they're there. And I, quite frankly, like, you know, I want him to go bigger. I want him to go farther. But at least in the context of the presidential election, we should all be anti-fascist, right? and I was happy that he said that it's an idea clarified, not an organization. And that's what, you know, as AOC says, it's about letting democracy live another day. And I will be proud to cast my vote for Joe Biden. I hope many other progressives are too. And the fight, I look forward to like day one fighting to make sure that everything, you know, following the pandemic, especially around healthcare, we do not get wrong twice, you know, and we cover every single person. When we think about climate change, like building the 21st century economy of the future and like saving our planet will take everything that we've got. And so I think it's going to be more work holding his feet to the fire, but you know, with Joe Biden, we have a chance to actually make things better, not just fight to put out fires.
And finally, can you tell AOC that I'm very sorry?
Oh boy,
that I screwed up.
So
and that so I'm so sorry. And
I apologize, Alexandria.
And
I apologize.
Secondly, can you ask Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez if she would be willing to be on our podcast so I can apologize personally, as well as perhaps ask other questions about the future of America.
And also,
yeah, I mean,
if
I'm, I'm trying, I've got some asks as well, so don't. Yeah,
exactly. That's going to be
so
real low
I
on the
I look
list.
Forward to hearing back.
And if she wants to come on the podcast but only have me interview her, that's fine too.
You can't do that, Kamau. It can't, it can't be Desus or Mero. It's Desus and Mero. Alexandra Rojas is Executive Director of Justice Democrats.
And you can learn more, donate, volunteer, and spread the word at jdems.us, letter J-D-E-M-S.us. You can still get involved in their work for Kari Eastman's campaign and the Justice Democrats Caucus, or nominate someone you believe should run for Congress at jdems.us. Hurry, do you know anyone, like somebody who's close to you, who you think really should be in a leadership role in this country?
I do, but do you think Boots Riley will do it? Coming up, are you overwhelmed by cynicism and in search of reasons to have hope for American democracy?
Oh, I am.
Well, you don't need to worry, because in a moment we're going to have Desmond Mead on, and he'll give you some hope.
I need hope.
In 2018, Desmond Mead led the campaign for Amendment 4, the grassroots initiative that changed the Florida Constitution so that people with felony convictions who had served their time and returned to citizens would have the right to vote.
Until the state's Republican Party went into action to undo it, it was the largest expansion of the franchise in the U.S. for nearly 50 years. 1.4 million people, including 1 in 5 black people in Florida, had their voting rights returned to them.
Since Amendment 4 passed, the organization Desmond leads, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, has continued to fight discrimination against people with convictions, registering them to vote and helping them pay off fines and fees that have been used to block them from registering.
And Desmond's new book, Let My People Vote, was released this week. Let's talk to Desmond.
Do you remember the first time we met? Because I sure do.
Yeah. I think it was through Pastor Mike.
Pastor Mike, yep. Yeah. Yep, I think we were in New York. I think, were you in New York?
That was the time that we met in person. I was going into the studios. You was coming out.
That's right. Yep. That's right. Yep. Yeah. And you were like, come out. I know Pastor Mike. And I was like, oh, Desmond. Ships passing in the night. Yeah, that was the first time we met. I'll never forget that because at first I was like, who is this? And then you said the keywords Pastor Mike. I'm like, oh, okay, all right. Yeah.
Yeah, you know that name either going to get me in some doors or going to get some slammed in front of me. Yeah, I tell you, that's a name that I don't mind keep saying. I tell you that.
I feel the same way. He's been a guest on the show, and so our listeners all know the power of Pastor Mike. So as we sit here today, we're within hours of like the final day for people to register to vote in Florida. How are you feeling right now?
Yeah, man. I'm tired, but I'm a good tired, you know? Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, really excited over the last few months, to be honest with you, with what's been going on here in Florida with the restoration of voting rights for people with felony convictions and with the litigation that's been ongoing now for over a year, you know, and the highs and the lows. And you mix that in with what's been going on throughout our country with the coronavirus and what's been going on even with the killings of black men and women. And, you know, it's all just one hodgepodge of, you ready for this?
Yes.
Hope.
Oh.
Hope. You know, a lot of people are looking at, you know, how dark these times and uncertain these times are. But, you know, I'm really viewing this as a moment of hope because two things. Number one, when I was homeless, you know, I'll never forget when someone told me that the darkest part of the night is right before dawn, right? And as I see throughout this country where there's so much division and hatred and fear going on, you know, and things burning down, and I'm just reminded that out of the ashes have the opportunity for a phoenix of renewed hope to emerge, man, and to really imagine a new democracy, not the old democracy, but a new democracy and a new direction for this country to where people are treated with respect and dignity, regardless of their sexual identity or immigration status or color of their skin or previous conviction, that they're treated as we're all God's children. And so I have hope, man, because I see the young people that's rising up with a sustained vigor to really call out the systems that have been very oppressive for decades. And I see returning citizens excited about finally being able to be a part of our democracy. So I have hope.
Well, I got to be honest, Desmond. I didn't think hope was the four-letter word you were about to say, so.
But listen, we get the hope through the other four-letter word, which is love. You know what I'm saying? That's how we do it. We get the hope through love. Yeah, without love, we can't have hope.
Yeah, hope, love, vote. These are all four-letter words. Again, not the four-letter words I thought he was going to say.
All but right, that's why so without love, we get the hope. Yeah. And with hope, we can vote. And yep. When we vote, we got to come up with another four-letter word, right?
Well, one thing I know about you, and I believe this, is that this country only gets better with big, impossible-sounding ideas being made real. And you, at some point, engaged in this big, impossible-sounding idea of giving felons back their voting rights, which is one of those things that we just sort of, many of us sort of accept that if you commit a felony, you lose your voting right. It doesn't make sense when you think it through, but that's just, we just accept that's the way it is. So talk about how you conceived that idea and why it was so important.
I think that, you know, one of the things that really drew me to this was my own personal experience. You know, as a person who was, I was homeless, I was hooked on crack cocaine, standing in front of railroad tracks, waiting on a train to come so I can jump in front of it, right? But the train didn't come that day, and I crossed those tracks, and I walked a couple blocks further, checked myself into drug treatment. When I completed that, moved into a homeless shelter. While there, enrolled in school, did extremely well, and eventually got accepted into law school, and eventually graduating law school with a Juris Doctorate degree. And so when you talk about the journey from a person who thought that there was no light at the end of the tunnel, who had no self-esteem, who was ready to check out, to emerge as a law school graduate to eventually become Time Magazine 100 Most Influential Person in the World in 2019.
Say it again.
Right. Time Magazine 100 Most Influential, not in the country, but in the world. Yeah. Right. Right. So to talk about that journey, how could you not be audacious enough to think of something greater for our country? How could you not? If I can do it, man, anybody in this country can do it. And if anybody in this country that can do it, that means that we as a country, we as a nation, we as a group of people have an opportunity to do amazing things, right, through love, not through hate, fear, division. And that's what we did with Amendment 4. We actually took the most controversial topic that was out there, and that was restoring voting rights to people with previous felony convictions. We did it in the most controversial state, which is Florida, right, in the most pivotal state, which is Florida, right? And we did it at a controversial time where we was in the midst of a political climate that breathed nothing but hate, division, and fear. And we were able to successfully pass this initiative with over 5.1 million people voting. And those votes represented a broad cross-section of Americans, from progressive to a conservative, from young to old, and every ethnicity in between and every socioeconomic status. And we did it with no opposition. And all of our votes, when you count them up, you'll see that none of them was based on hate. None of them was based on fear. But there were votes that was based on love. Man, Kamau, listen, and people might think, oh my God, he's selling a pipe dream. But guess what, Kamau? We see this every single day. Every single day we see this. We see this with the response to COVID-19. We see when politicians are involved, nothing happens and people die. But when you see the beautiful parts about the response to COVID-19 is when regular everyday people from all walks of life, right, and all different hues, right, actually come together to the aid of each other. We see it in the aftermath of hurricanes. We see it in car accidents. Right now, Kamau, I know, you know, the work that you do, but you're driving down your street, Kamau, and you see an accident ahead with somebody laying on the side of the road, and you decide that you want to stop, and you stop, you get out your car, and you run up to that person. Kamau, your first question is not going to be, did you vote for Donald Trump? You know, it's not going to be what's your immigration status.
Yeah.
No, it's not going to be what's your sexual identity or how much money you make. Your first questions are going to be, are you okay? How can I help? It is those moments that I know that we don't have to wait for a disaster or an accident to operate in those moments, that we can actually operate in those moments every day.
Desmond, I hate to focus on the negative, but after this amazing victory with Amendment 4, what happened? Because you said it was bipartisan support, 65%. You know, of people voted in favor of it. I mean, it's you know, refranchising people, it seems like a no-brainer. Like, this is what America is supposed to be about. It's the power to vote. It's about second chances. It's about forgiveness. It's about justice. So, and Republicans supported it too.
Yep.
So what happened between once Amendment 4 was passed as an initiative to now, where we still have people being denied the right to vote despite the passage of this incredible piece of legislation?
Some people look at it as a negative. I look at it as a moment of enlightenment, right? And it's how we approach these things. You know, I've said many times, where other people see obstacles, we see opportunities. You know, when other people might see a setback, we see an opportunity for us to step up, right? And so immediately after we passed Amendment 4, you know, we had a Florida legislature that decided, and I say that the arrogance of politicians to all of a sudden now want to decide how we implement Amendment 4, right? Mm. Now, let me put this in perspective to you, right? You're talking about politicians who for 150 years have walked past a homeless family living on the streets and did not raise a finger to help them. Right. Then all of a sudden, the people of that community come together, people from all walks of life, and said, we are going to fix this. Since you, Mr. Politician or Mrs. Politician, don't have the courage to do so, we're going to fix it. And the people come together and build the homeless family a house. No sooner than they build the house, the politician now wants to insert themselves in it and demand that they be in charge of how the house get decorated. Right. That's exactly what happened with Amendment 4. And when they did so, right, they codified the requirements of payments of legal financial obligations that a person would have to meet before they're able to register to vote. And the minute they did that, of course, a lawsuit was filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Legal Defense Fund, the Brennan Center for Justice, ACLU, and others. Right. And they took them to court and filed a lawsuit in the Northern District of Florida. And they actually won. They actually won where a judge said, hey, listen, a lot of these things that you're requiring, they are poll tax.
Say it. You know? Say it.
They are a poll tax. And the judge was very clear with that. A person being poor should never, never be a barrier to access to the ballot box. But Florida didn't like that because Florida believed that it's okay for a person to be forced to choose between putting food on their kid's plate or voting. That it's okay for a person to be forced to have to choose between paying their rent or their mortgage or voting. And sadly, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeal agreed with the state of Florida and overturned the decision in the Northern District and required that so many people, over 774,000 people, right, now have to pay their fines and fees. But like I tell you, people could look at it as a setback. We looked at it as an opportunity to step up. And you know what happened? That's exactly what patriots across this country did, right? I mean, from celebrities like a Michael Jordan or a LeBron James to a Ariana Grande to a John, the legend, you know, to corporations like Levi's and Viacom, right? To many foundations and many just average everyday citizens from all walks of life. Over 88,000 people stood up and donated an average of $300 and say we would not stand by and allow democracy to be held hostage in Florida. And so guess what happened? Florida wanted to give us a hard time. The whole country has risen up and has rallied behind returning citizens like me who want to have an opportunity to participate in democracy. And so we don't allow these tactics, you know. Sometimes, you know, people say, well, you know, that is voter suppression. I say it goes beyond voter suppression. I say that it's an affront to democracy, right? It's an attack against democracy as we know it, right? It goes way beyond that. It's deeper than that because it really stops people from being a human being. It really stops people from having their voices counted.
Just to clarify the tactics that were being used. So basically, when people voted on this, they didn't know that, like, the idea was, okay, so you'd serve your time, you'll pay off restitution. But the idea wasn't that you'd pay off all the restitution all at once. So you'd pay it off over the course of your lifetime. That's the expectation. What they didn't know is what was enforced was all the restitution, all the penalties had to be paid off completely, which immediately creates a barrier with people without money. And the part that gets me even more than that, because that's already shocking enough, is there is no centralized system to know how much you actually owe. So even if you think you paid it all off, you find out you didn't, but there was no way for you to know that.
I can tell you right now, as a person that has been involved with the process from the very beginning, that what we've seen when we had our focus groups and we did our polling, right, what we found that was very clear was people, when they was thinking about completion of sentence, what they meant was that you completed periods of incarceration, right? That's what they were thinking. And if you were on supervision, such as parole or probation, that you completed that, right? And then, of course, the restitution piece. But no one was thinking about these obscure fees and costs that were more administrative in nature that no one even knows about, right? One of the ones that I just shake my head at is that, you know, when a person is facing a criminal charge, there are afforded the constitutional right to have an attorney represent them. And if they are too poor to afford to acquire a private attorney, well, the court makes an assessment, find out that the person is indigent, and then assigns them a public defender. The minute they assign them a public defender, they're assessed the public defender fee. So they're being charged for being too poor to afford a private attorney. And then you have all these other obscure fees that can really add up, right, and really create a burden.
I feel like generally we put people who have been in prison in a separate category from the rest of us. So a thing that makes sense for them, we would never think makes sense for us. Like if you showed up to vote as somebody who had never been in prison, and they said, before you vote today, you got to pay your traffic tickets. It would sound crazy.
Yeah, right. Or your student loans.
Or your student loans. You got to pay all your student loans.
Right. Listen, if you have outstanding. And this was the funny part, right? And it was sad. when in the 11th Circuit opinion, there was actually a statement in there that basically said a person not paying their outstanding debts is indicated that they're not ready to be able, they're not qualified to vote. They shouldn't be worthy of voting. Releasing helium-filled balloons in the air, disturbing turtle nesting eggs, driving with a suspended license, right? Burning a tire in public, that disqualifies you for the rest of your life from being able to participate in our democracy? How ludicrous is that?
Disturbing turtle nesting eggs?
Yes, that's a third-degree felony in the state of Florida. And listen, I know one of you guys like to go lobster hunting. You catch a lobster, the tail is too short. Man, listen, that's a third-degree felony. You're not going to vote again. But thankfully for Amendment 4, we have a pathway for you.
You know, before I had heard your story, Desmond, I knew about the right to vote being denied to formerly convicted felons. Like I knew that, but I didn't know other civil rights would be denied as well. Can you tell us what rights you asked to be restored? Like, what else was taken from you other than the right to vote?
Yeah, so when anyone convicted of any felon, like, remember I told you that lobster whose tail?
Yeah.
Hurry's talking about lobster.
I'm not going to forget that.
Matter of fact, I'm going to give you an even better one, right? So Kamau, you know, rather than giving your significant other a dozen roses on Valentine's Day, you decide you want to release 12 red balloons in the air.
Yeah. Huh.
That's a third-degree felony in Florida. Oh. If convicted, you lose the right to vote for life, right? Which means that not only can you not vote anymore for the rest of your life, you cannot serve on a jury. You cannot run for office. And then there are collateral consequences that will prevent you from obtaining certain occupational license. So, Kamau, even if you turned your life around after releasing those 12 balloons in the air and have you graduated cum laude at the best law school in the country, you cannot practice law in Florida because you won't be allowed to take the bar until your civil rights have been restored. Mm-hmm. And even if you're trying to find safe and affordable housing for your significant other, and if you have kids, right, you are not allowed to own or even rent a home in a lot of subdivisions within the state of Florida, because written within these agreements are provisions that would prevent you from doing so until your civil rights have been restored. And so there are hundreds of collateral consequences that are attached to a felony conviction, no matter how big or small. And so them 12 red balloons, they just cost you a whole lot, right? And they only, but listen, they just can't cost you, Kamau. Here's the other part of the story that people don't think about. It costs our society.
Mm.
It costs every single one of us, right? The barriers that we put in front of people with felony convictions have an adverse impact on our economy. Right, on our ability to keep taxes lowered, on the education of our children, because now they're spending 3, 4, 5 times more, right, to deal with you and your releasing red balloons than they are to be dealing with our kids' education.
How do you respond to people? Because, I mean, there's certainly a lot of cynicism about voting. Like, so many people, my vote doesn't even count, the Electoral College, what's the point? I mean, to me, it clearly counts, because if it didn't count, how come they're spending so much effort denying people the right if it didn't matter? So how do you respond to people who are so cynical? They're like, well, my vote doesn't count. What is the point of this?
At the end of the day, even if you don't recognize right now how valuable the right to vote is, how valuable your vote is, how powerful it is, just the fact that somebody's trying to get it from you ought to set off some kind of antennas that maybe I need to hold on to this and use this, because if somebody is seeing value in it, man, it must be something valuable. And, you know, I tell folks, you know, like when you walk into that voting booth, right, that is, a voting booth is the ultimate equalizer. And what I mean by that is that when you walk in that booth to cast a ballot, you have just as much power as Jeff Bezos. Or Bill Gates, just as much power, right? You have just as much power as the president of the United States when you walk in that booth. This is something that we have to value. This is something that we have to treasure. It's actually come out as long as I've been an advocate for voting. It wasn't until I got the opportunity to vote for the first time in over 30 years that it all came home to me. You know, and when I was walking up to the voting location, and my mind just started thinking about my ancestors that were murdered through state sanctioned violence, that was hung and burned and bitten by dogs and sprayed with fire hoses. And I brought also with me the spirit of the 700,000 plus people who was not going to have an opportunity to experience what I was getting ready to experience. And Kamau, when I walked into that location, I started approaching the booth that I was going to be by myself, right, making the decision on who I wanted to run my community. It dawned on me that I was in a sacred space, right, getting ready to commit a sacred act. And it was a level of sacredness that transcend partisan politics. It went beyond a Democrat or a Republican. It went beyond all of these anxieties and insecurities. And it took me to a place that said something so simple yet powerful. It said that I am. It says that I count. I am American citizen and my voice matters, right? And the sacredness of that moment, I would never forget. And I walked out of there with tears rolling down my eyes with my family with me, because I was able to take my family for the first time ever in my life to take my family voting with me, right? Reminiscent of the civil rights era. And as tears were streaming down my eyes, I couldn't help but to think, man, this feeling is so transformational that I need every last one of the 1.4 million to experience that. And I think when you understand the sacredness and the value of your vote and you get to experience that moment, you would never stop voting again.
That's beautiful, Desmond. That's beautiful. And I think when I think about those 1.4 million people, and also when you think about Florida as the idea, if we think of Florida as a swing state that you never know which direction is going to go, and you think about, I'm imagining that 1.4 million would swing that state pretty hard on our side.
Yeah, I'll tell you something even better than that, Kamau. That 1.4 million is going to swing any election on our side. And when I mean our, I'm talking about the people that's been beaten down by the system. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For centuries, right? People who were told that their voices didn't matter. People who experienced, right, we have like that knee on our neck. We've been experiencing that for decades, right? Mm-hmm. Being murdered in the street and our perpetrators not being prosecuted. We've experienced that for decades. Having people just bang our doors down and just start just creating trauma in our lives. We've experienced that for decades, right? And having situations of crisis in our communities, and we're the last ones to get help or to be responded to. Mm-hmm. I can't stop thinking about the flood in New Orleans, you know, and how people were just left stranded. All of that now has come to this moment to where the very same people that were shunned and ignored now has the power to determine the direction. You got to remember, 2000 election, it was what, less than 600 votes that decided the direction of this country. And every election ever since have been decided by an average of 100,000 votes. Mm. Right now, people with felony convictions, right, people who have loved ones that's been impacted by our injustice system now have an opportunity to ensure that their issues are at the top of the ticket. And it shows. It shows up. You've seen it during the Super Bowl, and you see it in a lot of these commercials. They're starting to pay attention to the issues that impact people like me. And that's because we got the power. We've got the right to vote, and we know how to use it.
How does it feel to know that some of these people are voting for the first time since they got their rights restored?
You know, I'm going to tell you exactly how I feel, right? Let me tell you, it was a young lady. We was trying to figure out if she was qualified to register to vote. And by the time we had figured that out, her doctor had given her 6 months to live. Mm. And as we went to her house, one of our canvassers went to her house and was helping her with the registration form. As she was filling it out, she just started crying, talking about how for over 24 years, Kamau, over 24 years, this woman had wanted to register to vote, but she couldn't because of a felony conviction and a drug addiction. And she thought she'd never be allowed to be able to vote again. And as she was signing her name at the bottom of the registration form, She looked up and asked our canvasser to pray that God would allow her to live long enough to cast that ballot, right? Now, here we have a woman that's given 6 months to live, and her dying wish was not to go to Disney World. Her dying wish was not to meet a celebrity or Kamau, or her dying wish was not to travel to an exotic place. Her dying wish was to be able to cast the ballot, to be able to experience what it feels like to be a citizen, to have your voice counted. That's what her dying wish was. And I remember I wanted to connect it to a reporter for her to share a story. And when I reached out, I found out that after she registered, her health took a turn for the worse and they had to rush her into hospice. Sadly, 4 days after getting to hospice, she passed away. And, you know, that just tore my heart apart, right? But it speaks to so many people who have that yearning to be a part of our democracy, right? To where, to some, it's their dying wish, right? And so you ask me how I feel, knowing that people are going to get the vote for the first time in their lives, people who are 51, 53, 59, in their 60s, who have never voted, how I'm going to feel? Oh, my God, man. Listen, I'm going to be overwhelmed just trying to imagine what's going through their minds and their bodies and how it's that act is going to complete them as a human being. Thinking about like people like that young lady who died without having that opportunity. Let me tell you, we got people who say they don't care if it's a dog catcher race going on. They're going to vote. They're going to vote. Now, that might not be everybody, but I'm telling you, there are people out there that's like that, and I'm going to be celebrating with them, right? Each and every one returning citizen that cast a ballot, I'm going to be celebrating with them on Election Day because I know that we are going to make a difference. Our voices are going to be heard and felt in this election.
Well, all right,
amazing.
Sir.
Amazing.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It sounds like you're about to be called to ministry for a second.
Mom, we're going to leave that to Pastor McBride, all right?
All right.
We're going to let him do that.
That was Desmond Mead, president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition.
Find out how they're defending and expanding the right to vote in Florida and give your support at floridarrc.org. That's floridarrc.org.
And Desmond's new book, Let My People Vote, is out now. You can order it at desmondmead.com. That's desmondmead.com. And Mead has an E at the end of it. That's it for this week. Thanks to Desmond Mead and Alexandra Rojas. And thank you for being with us as we relaunch Politically Reactive.
It's great to be back and part of this absurd moment in American history.
And you can have your voices heard too. Keep tweeting us, Facebooking, Instagramming us. Use the hashtag Politically Reactive.
Or leave us a message at 917-477-6525. That's 917-477-6525.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at WKamaubell, and somewhere on Facebook, I assume. And also, you can watch episodes of United Shades of America on HBO Max. I'd start with the one on white supremacy.
And you can follow me at Hurricane Ebolu on Twitter and Instagram. Also, you can watch both our Netflix specials, Private School Negro and Warn Your Relatives. Guess which one is which? on Netflix. Still available. You can also watch my documentary, The Problem with Apu, the documentary that mailed 1,000 death threats. It's available on HBO Max and on Hulu. And finally, you should buy Who the Hell is Duane Kennedy? It's the debut full-length album of our friend, the legendary comedian Duane Kennedy. Kamau and I executive produced it with Mayfle J. Oluo, who did most of the work. And you should totally listen to it. He's a legend. Listen to Who the Hell is Duane Kennedy?
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Hurricane Ebolu.
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin and Malachi Seeger Sakir. Will Statton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
This show is dedicated to the memory of Rahwa Hapte, an amazing organizer and friend in Seattle, Washington. Rest in power, Rahwa.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.